The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Thanks, Steve. I have to talk to you about my commentary because when it first came out, I remember reading it at home, and every now and then I'd shake my head and say, Silva, what are you trying to say here? But speaking of the commentary, back in, I think it was 1985, early in the summer, I had completed the first draft of that, and I have some vivid memories about that day. It was a Friday afternoon, I can tell you that. And I recall taking the last segment of that longhand manuscript to Dorothy Creakey for her to input into the computer. And even though it was a rough draft, and I knew I still had quite a bit of work to do, there was a genuine sense of relief. I was already about half a year past my deadline. But I was relieved, and I thought, well, now I can enjoy my vacation in Florida. On the way back from Machen Hall to the library, relaxed as I was, I decided to browse the new book section in the library, and staring at me in the face was a brand new, extensive, detailed, technical commentary in Philippians in German. That was my summer vacation. I was still working on the final draft of the commentary a couple of years later, but now I really thought I could detect the light at the end of the tunnel. Sure enough, it was the oncoming train. I came into the library. I love our library. And there was this recently published 450-page dissertation on Philippians 2, 1-11, in Italian. Begin to see a pattern here. Last fall, Larry Sibley asked me whether I would like to take chapel and preach in Genesis 11. And, this is a passage I had done a fair amount of work on. So even though I was going to have something of an overload in the spring, it just seemed like a reasonable thing to take on. So a couple of months ago, I walk into the library office, bless their heart, and lying on the desk is this monstrous, dirty pink volume, here it is, about 630 pages long, on Genesis 11, 1-9. In German, of course. Weltreich und eine Rede, eine neue Deutung, eine neue Deutung, a new interpretation of Genesis 9. Now, knowing that most of you would be intimately familiar with this material, I felt a responsibility to take it seriously, so I checked it out, have carefully read the table of contents, and on the last page is an English summary. But the question is, what would possess anyone to do this kind of research, 24-page bibliography, and write over 600 pages on nine measly verses in the Bible? Well, they're not measly, are they? This unpretentious little story has had an impact completely out of proportion to its length. Everybody knows about the Tower of Babel, whether or not they understand its real significance. You tell this story about the great skyscraper to a bunch of little kids, and you see their eyes open wide. Tell a story to an intellectual like this fellow, look what he does with it. Part of the reason, I suppose, is that this brief narrative has been masterly crafted. The great Jewish scholar Umberto Casuto called the passage a fine example of biblical literary art. If you were a Hebrew audience listening to it, you wouldn't miss the use of assonance, particularly the recurring sounds of ba or va, la, na, those kinds of sounds. The very initial suggestion, come, let's make bricks, is hava nil bena leveinim. And those kinds of sounds keep recurring throughout the passage until you get to the climax of the story, and its name became Babel. But technique isn't used just for the fun of it, phonetic fun, you know, but it supports the substantive thrust of the story. It's a beautifully organized story, two very neatly sections, neatly balanced sections. And the old phrase, man proposes but God disposes, is powerfully illustrated there. The first four verses recount the human purpose. Come, let us do such and such to reach the heavens. The last five verses announce God's disposition. Come, let us go down and frustrate their designs. The contrast between those two sections is really enhanced by mockery. You know, in the first part, you're told about the fact that these people use, instead of stone and mortar, those were the strong materials that a Canaanite would have used, you see, to build a tower. But these wicked and foolish people use these fragile bricks and tar. That little comment, you see, isn't for information about architecture. It's a certain sarcasm. How foolish these people. In the first part, you're told that they desired a great name. On the last part, the name their city received was laughable. To the Mesopotamians, it may mean gate of the gods, Bavilu, but to us Israelites, it is Babel, confusion, Babel. The first part, their grand purpose was protection, lest they be scattered over the face of the earth. And when you get to the to the end of the story, we're told the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. Now, to be sure, the fascination that this story has exerted throughout the centuries goes well beyond matters of artistry or even moralism. The subject matter is really intriguing, I suppose, primarily because language is such an important part of our human experience. And most people are, I suppose, everybody, I suppose, is existentially confronted with the reality of linguistic confusion and lack of understanding. Maybe that's particularly true of bilinguals, a pitiable group indeed. And I have a few stories of my own about this. Might as well tell you a couple of them, particularly since there is a romantic twist to them, besides nearly the end of the semester. I want to go back to my college days, back in the Middle Ages. I should make it clear, though, that we're talking about the later medieval period. There's some faculty here who really go back to the Dark Ages. I belong to the later, virtually the Renaissance, the early 60s, you know. But keep in mind that although I had been exposed to English throughout my childhood and teen years and so on in Cuba, we had been living in the States permanently for only a couple of years when I went to college. And so from time to time, there were certain subtleties of English that would escape me. My freshman year in college had its ups and downs. At Christmas time that year, I went back to visit my family in Miami and to attend something of a homecoming banquet sponsored by my high school. Surprisingly, I had a date for this banquet. She was a high school classmate for whom I had some fondness. The evening went pretty well, I thought, anyway. As I was driving her home on the Palmetto Expressway, for some reason, we got to talking about the Orange Bowl, which was going to be held within a week or so. And I just happened to ask her whether she enjoyed attending big spectacles like that. And she said, oh, yeah, she loved going to those things. To which I responded, continuing this small talk, that I myself didn't particularly care for big crowds. When we got to her house, I gallantly kissed her hand. And that was the end of that. Back in college, a couple of weeks later, I got to thinking about that conversation for some reason. And as I reviewed the whole conversation in my mind, all of a sudden it occurred to me that things hadn't gone quite the way that I have just described them to you. It became clear to me that she hadn't said, oh yes, I'd love to attend things like the Orange Bowl. What she really said was, I'd love to. Which means that I did not ask, do you like, but would you like to go to the Orange Bowl? And then after she told me how much she'd like to have another date with me, I pointed out how much I hated going to these things. Now, I'm sure it's a coincidence. For over a quarter of a century, I've been trying to get a hold of her without any success. But here is linguistic confusion. It was a frustrating experience because I really like that girl. But what do you know? Shortly after that, came the beginning of the spring semester in college, which meant new seating assignments in the dining commons. Every few weeks, we would rotate tables, you see, which was intended to enhance our socialization. It may sound a little artificial to you, had its advantages. As I approached that new table for the first time, I was stunned when I saw the ineffably beautiful creature that was going to be sitting across from me. It soon came out in the conversation that she had a boyfriend back home, but apparently that just gave me greater boldness, because within a day or two, I announced to her in front of everybody that I was going to marry her. Now, she didn't eagerly embrace that suggestion, but the following year, in the fall, a few weeks into the fall, I thought I detected a certain interest on her part. Now, granted that sometimes I suffer from a lively imagination, but I just couldn't just ignore it, especially after all my daydreaming during my summer vacation. So I asked a mutual friend whether perhaps she had broken up with her boyfriend back home. Disappointingly, she hadn't. But the next couple of weeks, there was just something about the way that she was looking at me that simply couldn't be disregarded. I know you're wondering whether I've got forgotten what I'm supposed to be doing in chapel, but I promise you this will be over sometime today. At any rate, I simply had to take action, you see. So I asked her for a date. In that setting, by the way, the proper procedure was to write a note, and of course you wouldn't put the note in the mailbox. That was tacky. You used the note system. A group of guys would come to the men's dorms at about 9:30 at night, pick up all the notes, run them to the girls' dorms, pick up their notes, bring them back, at which time pandemonium would break loose, every guy hoping to receive a nice mailing envelope. Well, I tried this, and the answer was no. But you see, there was something about the way she said no. Not only that time, but the next several times I asked her out, that it was just obvious that she just wanted me to keep trying. Now, I think it was the fourth or fifth attempt when I felt maybe I needed to start out with some kind of an apology for being such a nuisance. And here's where my Spanish let me down. Turns out that the usual Spanish word for to bother someone is molestar. Now, remember, I wasn't real sharp on lexical subtleties, so I began the note by saying, "I am very sorry that I keep molesting you." She turned me down that time, too. But if you're wondering about the sequel to the story, this June we will be celebrating our 25th anniversary. Now, I know what you're thinking. Silva ran out of things to say about the text. So to fill up the time, he comes up with this completely irrelevant old story that, according to the rules of grammatical historical exegesis, has absolutely nothing to do with the Tower of Babel. Well, whether or not my story has a bearing on the text really depends on what you think the story is doing here. Many of us, consciously or unconsciously, tend to look at this passage and other sections in Genesis primarily as intended to provide historical information for us. Now, don't misunderstand me. I have no doubts whatever that Genesis 11 relates a historical fact. And it's a very interesting question how that may relate to discussions about the origins of language, diversity, and so on. But the truth of the matter is that we miss the point of the passage if we view it as an etiological narrative. You know, it's trying to answer some question. If we think that the story is intended to satisfy human curiosity, there are hundreds of other things that people are curious about, and the Bible doesn't talk about them. The primary point of the story is, of course, theological. Here we have the last narrative prior to the setting of the call of Abraham. It brings to a conclusion the so-called primeval history. Now, I know that a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Longman told you that the flood story is the climax of this portion of Genesis. But, of course, the flood story happened to be his text. My text is the Babel story, and I am telling you that this is the culmination. I say the culmination of what? Three things, yeah. This is a three-point sermon. But these 3 points have been hammered at you so many times this semester that we can cover them quickly. First of all, there is a sense in which the story tells us about the culmination of sin. Now, I don't mean to imply that the particular sin recorded here is the greatest sin of all. That's not the point precisely. But I do believe that the writer intends for us to see this event as the most explicit and blatant expression of human autonomy. Don't have to be Evangelian to see this. Even Klaus Westermann in his commentary on Genesis is very clear about that. He specifically describes it as an expression of human autonomy. Satan's original invitation, you will be like God, continues to exert its power. Remember the motivation behind Lamech's boastful cry, I will avenge myself far better than God can do it. That becomes here a determined goal to avoid God's command to fill the earth. They will knock on the very gates of heaven to achieve their purpose. We all have our ways to proclaim our independence from God. Some of you who've had intro may remember the Stoic slave Epictetus and, you know, his acknowledgement that, oh yes, his possessions and even his body may be at the mercy of circumstances and the tyrant or whatever, but as for his soul, he said, not even Zeus has the power over that. I was amazed some years ago when I was teaching back in Southern California in an evangelical college, someone spoke in chapel, a fellow who was something of a psychologist or something, and said the same thing Epictetus said. Now, I doubt that he had ever read Epictetus, but he argued that all of us, regardless of what it may appear like outside, beneath all of our problems or whatever, we have a little garden inside, he said. We all have a little garden that we tend, you see. And in that garden, he said, only each individual person can go. Even God, he said, even God cannot come into my little garden unless I say that he can. Well, you know, the rest of us perhaps are not quite that blatant about it, but we all have our various ways to exclude God from our lives. We want to be our own gods, and I think this story, if nothing else, ought to remind us of this impulse that all of us experience. We don't want God and his claims over us. And secondly, there is the culmination of judgment. True, the division of languages and the scattering of the people at first sight do not seem quite as catastrophic as Adam and Eve's expulsion from the garden, or as destructive as the flood. But think about it. Our failure to communicate clearly and accurately, or to understand each other, is the source of great, great alienation. I think we make a mistake if we limit the thrust of the passage to lack of communication between people who speak completely different languages and cannot understand each other in any way. Some of the deepest conflicts of all take place not merely among people who are having bilingual problems or what have you, but people who share the same native language, even people who may even belong to the same family. How many times have you seen before your very eyes two people arguing, perhaps calling each other diplomatically liars or heretics? And you can see clearly that there's simply a breakdown in communication, but you just feel helpless to resolve the situation. Or how many times, and my little story, you see, is very relevant here, because how many times in the closest relationships have you said something that has been misunderstood, completely misunderstood? Your friend, your spouse, your parent, and you know perfectly well that any attempt you make to salvage the situation will get you deeper in the mud. Alienation, language, and communication more generally, you know, including facial expressions and body language and so on, all of that affects our existence beyond measure. The very first divine activity we read about consists of God speaking and creating the world through his word. As men and women created in the divine image, we speak constantly. But because that image has been distorted by sin, we make a mess out of our speaking. out of the same mouth come blessing and cursing, edification and destruction, truth and lies, understanding and confusion. But there is that third item. Here we have the culmination of grace. Now you might wonder, where is grace in this passage? If you can't see it, most commentators don't seem to either. Von Rad says explicitly that there's only judgment and no grace in this story. But think about God's enigmatic comment here. If these people are allowed to achieve their goals as God, they will not be prevented from doing whatever they want. Is God afraid that people will become stronger than he is? It's absurd. There's probably a connection here with the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the garden. When God acts to prevent them from eating of the tree of life, is God afraid of something here? Why is he doing this? Well, perhaps because that fruit was intended to confirm them in their state. There's some speculation. It's not real explicit in the text, but I think there's something to that. In some way that we cannot well understand, that action, now that Adam and Eve have been affected by sin, would have confirmed them in unrighteousness, would have placed them outside of the pale of salvation. And the same principle can be seen in connection with the flood. The flood came not only to destroy, but to preserve. If not checked by that destruction, the human race would have perished in sin forever. But God preserves that race through Noah and his family, and so here. Sinful human beings are determined in their stupidity to thwart God's gracious purposes. They think they will gain security if they keep God from scattering them, but they would only be placing themselves out of the possibility of salvation. And God doesn't allow it. By judging them, he saves them. By scattering them, he provides the setting for special revelation. The nations of the earth may be now under the darkness of Satan, but God chooses Abraham to be a blessing to all those nations. And not surprisingly, the very first thing that happens as the Holy Spirit is poured out to constitute the Church of Christ is that the linguistic division seems to disappear. People from virtually every corner of the Roman Empire are able to hear Peter in their native languages. Yet, the linguistic miracle of Pentecost is only a reflection of the healing of the nations from Jerusalem and Judea to Samaria, Antioch and Ephesus and Corinth and Rome and Spain and Cuba and Philadelphia, the end of the earth, the capital of linguistic confusion. Don't you see, as Zephaniah tells us, God is in the process of purifying the lips of the people so all of them may call on the name of the Lord. May we learn to call on that name, conscious of our sinful state and our sinful desire for autonomy, and grieving over the curse that has come upon our ability to communicate, but utterly grateful that God's power and grace prevail. May he give us the grace to understand that and act upon it to the glory of Christ.